sucks, Omar said. Language, Prakash admonished. They keep thinking that I am. I don't think that's quite true. Yes, Omar said, my classmates, it keeps happening, but I don't care anymore. Your parents are making the best choices they can, Omar. Prakash stopped kneading and covered the bowl with a dish towel before turning to wash his hands. Omar was proud that Prakash was talking to him about these things, and so he went ahead with another question. Have you ever seen the Al-Qaeda websites?
What?
Prakash turned quickly to look at him. Have you ever watched their videos, like on YouTube or anything? No, Prakash said, and I don't wish to. Have you?
I didn't like it, Omar said, trying to reassure him, but they said some things. They say they want to make the world better for people like us.
Prakash looked shocked. Omar, the world they want would not be better for you or for me or for anyone that we know. The world they want is unjust and violent. Please tell me you won't watch those videos again.
But why do I get in trouble just for asking about it? Just for watching what they say? What's wrong with doing research on them?
Omar's voice, against his will, sounded babyish. Prakash did not let him off the hook. I think you know, Omar. Those men are enemies. And if you choose to listen to their words, then our government will not like it. And now that you have had one problem, you cannot do it again. You cannot. Is that clear?
Omar cast his eyes at the table.
Omar, is that clear?
I heard you.
Omar slumped in his chair. Amina appeared and looked between them. Omar felt a moment of panic and sat up, thinking that Prakash was going to report him. I am letting the dough rest, Prakash said after a brief hesitation.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, our guest is Ramiza Shamoon Koya, author of the new novel, The Royal Abduls, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher, and author of the award-winning novel, Little Miss Strange.
You know, I'm glad you chose that passage, because Prakash is the most honest with Omar. He's
yes.
the one adult that speaks exactly what Omar needs to hear, and he tells him the truth.
Yeah.
He tells him the truth about why he took off his turban,
yeah.
and he tells him the truth about why he should not look at those videos.
Yes.
Because they're not good, and because he will get in trouble, and this is why. And he's the only
yeah.
adult that speaks straight to Omar, which is really tragic,
yeah.
because Omar is so bright, and he really wants to know. But then when Amina comes in, the conversation stops, and it's really too bad for Omar that it stopped right there.
It does, and there has repercussions. And, you know, I think a lot of the adults are trying to be protective, but also are very much in denial. You know, his mother and his father, you know, even Amina is still working through the kind of the same issues. They're working through them together, and she doesn't have a lot of clarity for him, and she doesn't know how to act or behave either. And so, you know, they have a wonderful relationship, and she's doing her best, but she doesn't know how to play that role either.
No, she's in a hybrid zone too.
That's right, yeah.
I think this idea of a hybrid zone is fascinating. It's an amazing metaphor for everything.
Yes.
And I had to go, it's such an intriguing piece of language, hybrid zone,
yeah.
that I had to go look it up. So I'm going to read the definition that I found.
Okay.
Amina is an evolutionary biologist, okay. which is also an amazing metaphor for that character. Hybrid zones are areas where the hybrid offspring of two divergent taxa are prevalent, and there is a decline in the genetic composition of populations from one species or taxon to another. And, of course, then I had to go look up decline, which is a gradation of one or more characteristics in the different population of this species. So you studied anthropology for a while. How did you come up with the idea of a hybrid zone? And there are whole passages about her work in
yeah.
hybrid in evolutionary biology.
Mm-hmm.
So did you know anything about the wild silk moth before you wrote this book?
No. I, in graduate school, studied cultural anthropology, and I had a roommate in this little tiny tenement apartment on the Lower East Side, and she was the one who was studying what's called
or sometimes called physical anthropology, but bears a strong resemblance to evolutionary biology, which is where I took this. So I was me in all of my different ethnicities, and she was Bengali and Swedish, and she knew about hybrid zones, and so we called our apartment the hybrid zone. And I loved that very much. And she told me a little bit about it, and, you know, I don't know, the book was not even a star in the sky at that point. But when I started writing the story about Amina, the evolutionary biologist, I did want to write about hybrid zones. So I in some ways, I had to find two plausible, kind of fake plausible field sites, one in the Sierras and one in India. And so I did a lot of research, and I learned about this guy named William Sweetner, and I read some of his work, and I became attached to the idea of the moss, which became also a big metaphor in the novel. And I really loved the idea that it wasn't sort of butterflies or some beautiful thing, that it was some ordinary thing that could do this extraordinary thing, which is interspecies mating, which is technically impossible. But it turns out is possible in certain conditions. And I think that the site in India was at that point largely imaginary. I just kind of, you know, put together something that seemed like it might be plausible. But, you know, there was only so much I could find that I could use. And I didn't want it to be, I wanted it to be like kind of a fairly obscure, like, little thing. So at that point, I was closer to when I had been in graduate school and reading very difficult texts, so I could do that kind of research and understand it better than I probably could right now.
Did you do a lot of research into hybrid zones and moths that didn't end up in the book?
Probably not. You know, I probably used as much as I could, because there was only so much that I was capable of sort of rewriting in a way that I felt other people could understand. And I remember that was something, one of the copy editors, a comment was kind of like, I don't understand all of this, you know? And I was like, well, I wanted to keep it in. I felt like it was okay that some of it was might be confusing or difficult for somebody to understand. I wanted to just keep it because it was important to me and it was important to Amina, and because I found it fascinating.
Well, and it's just perfect for her place in the story and her place in the world, her place in academia as a woman, and her place in the family.
Yeah.
She encounters a lot of sexism. I think sexism is a big part of her struggle, both within her family and in her work.
Yes, for sure.
It's pretty much what gets her to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
And the idea of Washington, D.C. as a setting, that's another hybrid zone. That's just
right.
An amazing hybrid zone.
That's right.
Well, and actually so is California, you know, and then there's, you know, the cricket field when they go watch a cricket game. There's another hybrid zone. And Prakash owns a bookstore. There's another hybrid zone. There's just layers and layers.
Yeah.
There's layers of it. And that's what got me to the word fractal. I thought, this is a fractal.
Yeah.
So a fractal is a never-ending pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And there are infinitely complex patterns that are self-similar across different scales. They just repeat and repeat through reoccurrence, recurrence within the fractal itself. And they're images of, in physics, they're images of dynamic systems.
Yeah.
And it goes back to this idea of this story just, it's the same story for every one of these heartbreaking characters.
Yeah, I think that is a good metaphor for the way that the hybrid zones kind of repeat upon themselves. Yeah.
Well, what I especially love is that it's such a great metaphor for her experience of family. Her father is a really interesting character to me. He's a professor of English literature, and like old English literature, like Keats. He loves Keats. And her mother is a university wife.
Yeah.
And he returns to the idea of honoring his roots late in life. And so his struggle to define who he is and land in one place and then land in another is kind of what everybody in the family is essentially doing.
Yeah.
But Amina is probably struggling to do that the most and the least successfully.
Well, I think, you know, they have the grandparents, or Mo and Amina's parents, they're the immigrants, right? And they're Anglophiles, which is not, would not have been unusual for that generation. Lots of people would have been educated to be in love with Keats or Yeats or whatever, you know, and so they grew up in an Anglophone world in India, and coming to the U.S. as professors, or as for him as a professor, that felt very real to me, that that's how they would be. They wouldn't want to be, just as, you know, my father didn't teach me Hindi, people didn't. They came over and they assimilated, and they wanted to badly. And within academia, you could do that pretty successfully at the time. So I think that's kind of their story. But I really didn't want to tell an immigrant story. I wanted to tell a second generation story. And so Omar is born in America and is mixed race and is very much, you know, struggling with identity still, but just in a different way. And Amina and Mo as well, like, they aren't given guidance on how to be Indian Americans. And there are various points in the book, you know, where they mention, you know, kind of asking for more information or trying to get in touch with that and just not really being encouraged. And I think that's kind of classic. Some families do, and some cultures do, you know, very much insist on everybody sort of staying within the culture. But that's not always true. And I think for a lot of people in second generation, these issues do present themselves, because outsiders are looking at you and saying, you're a foreigner. And you're like, no, you know, my parents were born here. I was born here. And what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And that is a difficult experience.
Well, and it seems to have particularly affected Amina. She doesn't really seem to have a sense of rootedness, even when she, like, when she returns to, when she goes to D.C. and tries to reconnect with Mo and Marcy and Omar. She's just awkward at it, and yeah. Sometimes it's very funny. One of my favorite parts is when she, early on, when she goes over to dinner at their house, and they're sitting at the table, and they're, you know, trying to talk and not talking. And she says, this was what it meant to be part of a family, apparently. The unexpected onset of vaguely distasteful responsibility interspersed with nice home cooking. She felt pleased and disgruntled at the same time.
Yeah.
And she does. Every time they try to interact as a nuclear family, it goes sideways pretty fast.
Yeah, for sure. And I think for her, part of that comes that she doesn't want to be her mom. You know, she doesn't want to be this assimilated wife. That's very important to her. She wants her own career. She's very, very ambitious. And so she does have to kind of, you know, break away from her parents to do that. But also, she is awkward, and she is not an extrovert or a person who has tons of friends or likes to go out and party. She's a scientist and a geek, and, you know, that's her world. And does that make some things hard? Yeah. And she doesn't know how to interact with them. She knows that she wants to be closer to Mo. She knows that it's probably important to have family and be close to them, but she has no idea how to go about it.
Right. And part of that is the sexism that surrounds her. Part of it is that the experience of that particular family, but it's imbued with sexism everywhere she turns.
Yeah. I mean, the expectations upon her are not ones that she wants. She doesn't want to get married and have kids. She does leave her boyfriend in California because he's kind of saying, like, yeah, this is where this is going. And she says, no, I'm out. And that's part of her struggle with Prakash, whether or not she can be with somebody who is probably going to want those things. And, you know, she does appreciate family, I think. She just doesn't know how to do it. And she kind of gets sucked in by Omar and her heart and her love that you mentioned. You know, like, she empathizes with him, and she sees him, and she doesn't know what to do. but she recognizes that somebody's got to do something. Mm-hmm. And so she does step in and start to fill a much larger role than she was expecting.
So I see her as really strong and independent. And I got the feeling that she didn't see herself that way. Mm. That she sees herself, she questions herself constantly.
She does. I mean, she makes fun of herself. She's very sarcastic. I do feel like she has a strong sense of what she wants to do in career. And I think that is very underwritten. And I also feel like, you know, the sexism that is a part of that is very underwritten. And so, you know, encountering, you know, working in an office where you're the only woman, the billions of women can testify, you know, like that's a very difficult situation. And she is not somebody who is flirty or engaging in anything, but is always seen as a sexual being and encounters a huge amount of sexism all mm-hmm. around her. And I think that's a pretty normal experience.
I feel like Omar is the only one who really sees Amina for what she is, for the strong, amazing person that she is.
Yeah, he thinks she's amazing.
Yeah.
He thinks she's just the coolest. She does research, which is his, like, weird thing that he loves, and she knows stuff. He fantasizes that she knows a lot more about India than she does, but he finds whatever she does know and brings it out in her so that they end up trying to learn about India together. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really, I don't know if he fully understands how little she actually knows, but she pulls it off, you know, and they do it together.
They do. And some of the funniest scenes are in the book are about those attempts of the two of them trying to do Indian stuff, especially around food.
Yes.
The scenes around food are some of the funniest scenes
Agreed.
In the book.
Yeah, because she really can't cook.
No. And the restaurant scenes are just awkward and also made me hungry.
Yeah.
You do a good job of writing about food.
I love food, so that was easy.
Was it?
Yeah.
Why don't you read us a passage that you feel like shows us Amina?
Okay, great. So in this scene, something big has happened a little bit earlier, which is that Omar brought a decorative Indian knife to school and had it out and was expelled. Amina was in charge of him that weekend and kind of took care of it, but she doesn't really know what happened. She's arranged to go to the Museum of Natural History with Marcy and Omar, but Marcy gets a work call, and so she ends up taking him around on her own. So they start walking. It's real crowded, and she sees that there is an exhibition of Islamic artifacts, and she just decides to go for it. Suddenly determined, Amina led him over to the case. They stared in somber silence at the case of engraved swords and ruby-encrusted hilts, at the animal-featured handles and silver-threaded velvet scabbards. Amina's hair fell forward against her cheek, and she let it stay, shading her face. "What happened to your knife?" she asked, trying to sound indifferent. "The police took it," he said. "I can get you another one," Amina offered. He shook his head. "I'm not supposed to have knives now." Amina looked around and saw a bench in the next room. She led him in, and they sat amid walls carpeted in red and amber textiles. "What happened that day, Omar?" "It was an accident," his lower lip puffed out in defiance. "I won't tell your parents anything. I just want to hear your side." Omar shook his head, but a single tear slid down his cheek. "Did the boy say something to upset you?" The dark head shook again, but this time it seemed more of a wag. "What happened then?" Omar drew his lip in and bit it, tears running free down his face now. "I hate him. I hate him. I hate him." She reached into her pocket for a tissue and gave it to him. "Who?" "Davy Madsen." Omar pressed the tissue to his throat as if stopping a wound. "He said we were nothing. He said I wasn't even Indian because Indians were Hinduists and that I was a liar and their family wasn't special. He said that Muslims will all die when the U.S. has a chance. And then I showed him the knife and said I would kill him first." He sobbed and hiccuped and snot ran down onto his upper lip. "Okay, it's okay." She put an arm around him and he leaned his hot face into her shoulder. Then he lifted his head and looked at her.
I wanted to do it. I wanted to kill him with a knife. I would have. She tried not to let the shock show on her face. She took out another tissue and tried to wipe his face clean. You wouldn't have, Omar, she told him. Are you listening to me? You wouldn't have. Just because you wanted to doesn't mean that you would have done it. He started to cry all over again. She searched her mind for words that could soothe the hunger in his heart and the fear in hers. She understood his ache for reassurance that their family, history, the world made sense. But all she could think to tell him was that he should find a way to escape into an inner world to fiercely guard his solitude. Because there were no guarantees, and there were always people who were disappointing and cruel, and you could go your whole life searching but never find a place where you belonged. But she couldn't say that, not to an 11-year-old. How about some dino fries? She said. We'll get ice cream, too. He nodded his head, reining in his sobs. Chocolate sauce? Extra hot fudge and sprinkles, too, she said. And whipped cream! His face broke into a radiant smile, the smile of a child again. They left the carpeted room and followed the red signs to the exit. In the corridor, pandemonium continued unabated. She took his hand to guide him through a class of kindergartners, but even after they had passed through the pack, she still kept a hold on his sweaty, soft paw. They descended the stairs together, past skeletons and models and squares of printed text, endless charts of the unfathomable past, none of which pointed the route to a rational future. When they reached the cafeteria, he shook his hand loose, running ahead to locate the ice cream. She pushed back her hair with a sigh, feeling their separation like a pain. She poured herself a cup of black coffee and took it on a tray to where he stood in front of a vast array of confections conjured for the multitudes who visited this hallowed hall of science day after day, and she ordered him his sweet.
See, there's that fractal thing happening again. They're just, struggling to connect and doing all the right things, and it's kind of not working for them.
Yeah.
And as is always the way with youth, we kind of hope it'll sink in at some point. Talk about your decision to choose these two point of view characters.
Mm. You know, Amina was somebody that I really, really wanted to write a difficult, ambitious, career-driven character who wasn't motivated by traditional, woman things. I've got an essay coming out called Driving Home that's a little bit about gender and my kind of history with that took me a long time to kind of fully explore. And I think when I first started writing short stories, I almost always wrote from a man's point of view. And the reason was I felt like a man could do anything. And if you wrote a woman character, you had to write about sexism and oppression and things that they couldn't do. And I really, at some point, wanted to turn that around, and I started trying to find the voice of a really fierce woman. And to me, Amina, confused as she is still somebody who is really fighting the good fight and is uncompromising, and that's what I wanted to write.
Well, it's true. She always knows what she wants. She wants to study bugs. She wants to go to hybrid zones. But she's kind of her own hybrid zone.
Yeah.
The way she keeps having to fight off society's expectations, and she's not sure quite how to do that. There are only a couple places in the book where she's absolutely out front with people.
Yeah. Well, it's a hard thing to do.
As a woman,
you've got everybody arrayed against you, and people want with all good intentions. People believe that you must have children. People believe that you must be married. People believe that it's not okay to be a single woman or a woman who's focused on just her career. And very few women do overcome that. There's a lot of societal and individual pressure, not to mention things like love, that get in the way of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's constantly struggling with it. And, it's hard to disappoint your mother. It's hard to disappoint your boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so, like, all of those things, they're shaky for her. And she's still quite young, in the book. And she's not fully figured out her life. I mean, she's in the process of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you have those kinds of experiences in academia?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you weren't in the sciences. Do you think it's harsher in the sciences than in the humanities?
Well, I worked in the social sciences, so probably, yes. I did have really bad experiences, and I didn't feel like I was welcome or that I belonged, and I dropped out of graduate school.
Well, I know I've heard some of your wilder travel stories, too, and some of the stories I've heard have alluded to those same kinds of interactions.
Yeah, terrible sexism and racism all over the world. That is without a doubt some of the, obviously the worst, not, I don't know why I said obviously, some of the worst sexism certainly happened to me in India.
Mm.
Yeah, where I had some very dangerous experiences and was lucky to make it out relatively unharmed.
Uh-huh.
The place where I was most welcomed and seen was Morocco, where everyone assumed I was Moroccan. So I was very comfortable, and that's the one place I've ever been where people saw me as just them, and that was a remarkable experience.
Although that wouldn't have lasted because there would have been expectations on you as a woman and a mother.
Yeah, and I think that was a kind of a turning point, you know, as I described before. It wasn't just me, it was, you know, other people, like, why are you doing that with your baby? Why is your baby out of the house? They don't take the baby out of the house for like a year, you know, the baby's always swaddled, like that kind of stuff. And so my woman who came in to help out around the house and help us feed each other while we were both working and having the baby, you know, would just come in and be like, what are you doing? Why is she sitting up? Why is she doing this? You know, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And that stuff was really hard. I felt very isolated by that. So, yeah, that was a turning point.
So you came back and you came to Portland. In what way is Portland a hybrid zone?
I guess I wish it was a hybrid zone. I don't know that I think that it is. I feel like it is a more homogenous place than I've ever lived. And that part I don't necessarily like. I do like the lifestyle here, but I don't find it particularly complicated in that way.
So you think that the aspect of Portland that we tend to call the bubble, this little liberal bubble, is a factor of it not being a hybrid zone?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
So will your daughter read this book? Has she read this book?
She's read the book and identified all of the typos immediately in the arc in like the first day she had it, yeah.
What did she have to say about the book? She's 10?
She's 11
she's
now,
11.
Just like Omar, which is just a coincidence. Weird one. You know, I started writing the book before she was born.
Yeah.
So, no, she's a fan. You know, she tells everybody it's really good. I think she's very proud. She loves to read and write and always has and is always constantly starting books and not finishing them. But I think that's a good sign. I hope she, well, I think we have a little bit of a lineage. You know, my mom wrote too, and I write, and I think she's going to write as well. And I'm sure that that's, I'm sorry, because she's going to make, you know, 5 cents a year. But, but you know, like, it's also great. It's great to see that she's passionate about that and that she is proud of me.
Well, what else would you tell us about this? As kind of a wrap-up, what would you want to say?
Oh, my. I hope that people read it and talk about it and that it becomes part of a conversation. And I've been so moved by how the literary community here has embraced it and supported it. And, you know, I don't think I've ever understood gratitude more. And that's the Portland book community, and I'm so honored to be a part of it and to have that support and to have this experience with my publisher, Laura Stanfill, who has done amazing things with the book and is always, always advocating for it. And those things have been really moving to me, and really, it's been an incredible experience.
Well, I have to say that working with an independent press is another level of the fractal.
Yeah.
Right?
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you, Ramiza.
You've been listening to Ramiza Shamoon-Koya, author of the new novel, The Royal Abduls, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press, in conversation with Joanna Rose, Portland-based writer and teacher and author of the award-winning novel, Little Miss Strange. You can join Ramiza for the official book launch of The Royal Abduls at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland on Sunday, March 15 at 2 p.m., and you're all invited to the after party at Literary Arts, located at 925 Southwest Washington, just a few blocks south of Powell's. I'm Ken Jones.
Listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.